welcome everyone back, especially having just heard that one of our members was in a very serious car accident, extremely serious. He wasn't in the car even, the Honourable Kwabasa, and he was assisting someone whose car had turned over to just assist them, him and his two fellow colleagues. They were killed instantly when another car went into them, and he's critically injured in hospital. So, unfortunately, that happened, I think, late Friday night or early Saturday morning. So we are with Archim, but as soon as we get further details, we will communicate through the committee secretary. I think we all know who he is, and it's most unfortunate. I think some of you do come from KZN. I know our WIP does, the Honourable Ntuli. I also know the Honourable Lubenia does, for example. So it would be unfortunate that he doesn't get a visit at all from the committee, but as I'll explain just now, both the committee secretary and myself will be in Korea on Thursday. So, you know, and yourself too, Honourable Abenya, I hope. So that really leaves only Honourable Ntuli to try and make a visit on behalf of the committee. And we would try to see if there's any financial assistance he may get. But other than that, as we know, the constraints that Parliament is facing, so it would seem unlikely that he would be getting, we would be getting anything. So what we do need to do, though, is we started this later than expected, and you may ask why, because this was scheduled for the morning, as you know. But all of the committees were reclassified due to the constraints on venues and also the fact that parties, including the ANC, are finding it difficult to field members in all of these committees occurring simultaneously. So there is an attempt to try and sort that out, and certain clashes have been, they're trying to avoid those. So initially when the committee secretary was informed of this by the speaker's office, there was actually a sitting today at 2. So, you know, we had to schedule this for later, otherwise it would have been at 2 o'clock. So my apologies for the any inconvenience, and I'm sure I shouldn't say any, for the inconvenience both to DTI as well as members of the committee. We do need to do this, and I know Mr. Xavier Karim is with us now, and is also the he's the DDG, as we know, but he's got with him a director, I would imagine, of the same department there or unit, and that is, I hope I'm right, Ms. Soraya Adam. Right. I know there's water around, but maybe I'll just take this one here. And we already have totally full program. We are trying to get a change again, but that would only be effected maybe in 2 weeks. So we are facing this kind of problem right now. And this we thought would be particularly important because it is the investment treaties, which in our strategic workshop, you will recall, indicated that this had a high level of priority. But before we just allow you to proceed there, Mr. Karim, if we can just look at the official apologies that we do have. I've mentioned, of course, the Honourable Kwabasa beyond his control and obviously not in any position to give his own apology. But we also have here the Honourable Kotsi, um, who hasn't actually given a reason. And then we also have here the Honourable Impashlele, who does give a reason. And obviously he's in a much smaller party than the rest of us, and he's been invited by the President for the official opening of the President's hotline. Not the cold line, but the hotline. Okay, so obviously that took precedence over the cold lines down here. So, no, but we do respect that as well. We also have one from Honourable Kamalo, who is attending public hearings on the Peace Portfolio Committee of Labour, the Labour brokering. And again, that is a very critical issue that is, I'm sure we've all seen in the newspapers coming before Parliament. And, well, there again from the whip we have the Kwabasa, is that right, from his whip indicating what his position is. So who has not given an apology? The Honourable Turok, who else? Is that the only one? Yes, Honourable Indikalada.
Honourable Tulok is always been.
Is there apology?
Okay.
I'm not suggesting we won't try and find out, but you were not appointed any secretary, you see, so so he's got two of them, and I'm sure one of them will be furnishing this committee with what is called an official apology soon. Thank you very much. To enable us to proceed at this point, because it's half an hour late, I'll just check with Mr. Karim how long do you require for your presentation, not the questions, clarifications, but your presentation.
Thank you very much. I will introduce the topic. I'll be about 10 minutes, and then I'll hand over to Sureya to take us through the presentation. I think we'll need about 40 minutes or so.
It won't be more than an hour, so that's fine. Okay, but just before you start then, let me say this, that we'll have a rolling tea break, quite obviously. If you see the Honourable Lavinia walking out, it was at my request to consult certain members of her party. There is the trip to Korea that has finally been approved by Parliament, but it was at Parliament's request that we attend. The space falls under this committee, as we've since learnt. Not the exploration of space per se, but rather the trade and industrial aspects of it, including the financial aspects. And there's an international, it's got some fancy title, seminar in this area, dealing with agreements, etc., the costs of the insurance or the risk undertakings and so on. And this happens, I understand, every second year. And they rotate the countries involved. It's in Korea. And the reason we could not skip is because South Africa is hosting it next year, so it must be every year. Oh, the 2011, well, in 2 years' time. So it was important then for us at least to see how they do things so as not to have any mishaps when we did host it here in 2011. So that's the purpose of that attendance. The different committees have been identified, I'm not sure how, so let me leave it there, other than I know why trade and industry was identified. Okay. And all I can say is that would mean that I would be away from after Wednesday's meeting tomorrow until the 12th, I think that's a Monday, and then I should have been, and then should be back on Tuesday the 13th, but because as chairperson I was asked to speak at the National Credit Regulator, as is customary on when they have their annual whatever, I won't be here until that afternoon. And so our meeting will go ahead on Wednesday. I need to say that it is not specifically a trade and industry invitation per se. It is an invitation that went to Parliament as such. And we were brought on board. People from the science and technology I know were brought on board, but I know the chair is not attending because he's in Sweden. But somebody else is attending in that respect. So I do open that up for questions in case there are any, but that's as much as I can give you. Yes, thank you, Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just find out who of the committee is going and on what basis has that been decided who will be going?
On the basis of we've got three things, I think, international type events occurring this year. But not this year, my apologies, the financial year or that kind of issue. In other words, until April, if I understand. And this was on the basis of needing to include both our official opposition as well as other political parties in what would be three events occurring during that particular time. So the names were put forward as to who would, you know, more likely be able to attend. We have something else. I think I need your assistance here, Mr. Hermans. I think it is another European issue happening early next year or in November. And it would be more important that the opposition do accompany the official opposition accompany us on that trip. This is a more an information type of issue, which if I could get out of, I would have got out of. I requested to get out of it due to the National Lotteries Board, but I was refused permission. So that was the basis I gave, the fact that there were two of you, but we did need, of course, yourself. On the other hand, there, the DA was assisting in one aspect of the National Lotteries Board and could not be released. That was yourself, Honourable Van der Westhuizen. Not yourself, I must hasten, as well as the Honourable Labenia was available. PAC is just a much smaller entity that would come in when we have a larger delegation going on. COPE as well, we have one person sitting in that respect. So in fact, it was only two parties that could have been eligible on that basis. And I've given that forward to you. But of course, these things are, as it's not a DTI issue, or a trade industry issue, it's also decided at a higher level as well. But I should make it clear that not before I've even raised it officially in the committee on what the issue is, that we do want the official opposition to participate in the European Union trade agreements issue, which occur in Geneva, Strasbourg, and Brussels. And I think that's also at the request of the DA. But I don't know. I would be saying something I don't have direct information on. I only know what I know. It would suit the committee because that is our greatest priority. Our greatest priority is not space in this committee. I don't convey that to the minister. But it really isn't. No, I understand there are five in Parliament. I don't know who the others are entirely. Yes, that's all. It's two. Two from ourselves. There's somebody else I know that replaced the chair of science and technology because he asked me if I was going, and I said I didn't have a choice. But I do not want to speak for other committees in Parliament. I understand that there were four or five, but that went to at a higher level than myself personally. So I want to be quite clear on that. I think part of the problem as well is that even the SAEU issues coming up, which the DA knew before me. Mr. Davidson made himself available before I even got the invitation. the SAEU issue. And remember, he came down to S26, or G26, and I didn't even know what he was talking about. So these things are not working from deep, from trade and industry. Let me make that quite clear. They work at a much higher level of the speaker's office. All right, thank you. I hope, you know, if there are any clarifications, because we've tried to maintain transparency within the committee, and I believe so far we've succeeded. But if there are little slip-ups here and there, we need to know before they create damage to the working relationship in the committee. And I know that you would make that open to myself. Are there any other questions?
Can I just add, Madam Chair, if I can? For me, it's not about going overseas and doing a trip. If there was a choice for me as well, I would have rather stayed home. So it's not an issue of dying, but I think it's very much a matter of everyone should get the opportunity. I think the committee has worked on an incredible transparent way, which has been incredibly constructive. And obviously my plea will be just that we proceed along that way, and that other people don't force something in between us. Thank you.
And that will be respected. I may, this is, as you said, at the strategic workshop, we took a decision as a committee that every member of this committee would from time to time go to seminars and whatever. Do you remember that decision? And that on occasions the chair would not necessarily go. It doesn't suit me always to be out of the country. I think everyone would agree on that point. So that's why we've tried to establish little task teams. I can assure you if there's a lotteries board or gambling board issue that we ask to attend in Los Angeles, I will not be going. But I think that Njikalana and Honourable Van der Vesthuizen would be our choices. Do you follow what I'm saying? Certainly not myself. I really have too much on my plate to be other than going to a casino. Thank you. No, not that the casinos aren't important. Right. Over to yourself, Honourable. Mr. Karim.
Thank you very much, Chair. I wanted to also thank the committee for the opportunity given to the department to present an update on the department's review of the policy framework for investment agreements, notably bilateral investment agreements. I think we had raised the issue that we had raised this in previous discussions with the committee that we are undertaking a review of our investment agreements, so we thought it would be useful to have this opportunity just to give you an update of where we are in that process. Just a little bit of a background, before that we turn to the presentation. I'm going to give some introductory remarks to this before we get to the presentation that's on the overheads now. The review was initiated in 2007, but I think we only began to make serious progress in terms of the substance of the review in the course of last year. The motivation for the review, there were several considerations that gave rise to this need. I think the paramount was the fact that prior to this process, South Africa has not formally put in place any agreed policy framework that could guide negotiations on bilateral investment treaties. The historical background to this is that in the immediate post-apartheid period, in 1994-95, we signed several bilateral investment treaties, mainly with European countries, which became a standard for our future investment agreement negotiations. It became a model for future investment agreements. There was never any proper assessment of the need for investment treaties. There was never a consultations around why we needed it, what they would look like, what were the objectives on them. But essentially, these were seen at the time as part of our re-entry into the international community. They were seen as part of South Africa's rejoining the international community after the isolation period under apartheid. I think over a period of time since 1994, perhaps by the turn, by the end of 90s and the early this millennium, we began to realize that many of the bits that we had concluded did not strike an appropriate balance between the need on the one hand to protect investors in South Africa with the need to preserve the rights of the South African government and the South African state to undertake policies to promote socioeconomic development. From around 2002, DTI negotiators who are responsible for negotiating, taking the lead on negotiating investment agreements and bilateral investment agreements in particular, began to, on their own volition, insert provisions into these negotiations that would allow, would ensure that South Africa wouldn't be challenged, some of its policies wouldn't be challenged, particularly black economic empowerment programs. Some of the earlier agreements could be interpreted as being in as making these policies vulnerable to international challenge, particularly provisions that relate to national treatment, to expropriation, etc. So on DTI's own volition, we began to insert specific clauses to try to avoid those challenges. We also, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, began to draw on a range of international multilateral processes that were discussing investment treaties and discussing investment agreements that provided important lessons and important insights into some of the dangers and some of the issues that would arise in investment agreements. And here I'm talking about the failed attempt by the OECD countries in around 1998 to conclude a multilateral investment agreement, the failed attempt in the WTO to insert an agreement as part of the Doha round, in fact, on trade and investment. We also drew on experiences that were coming out of disputes that had arisen in the North American Free Trade Agreement that has a chapter on investment, and some important disputes had taken place in that, and these were important for us to take cognizance on. And there was also a flurry of international investment disputes and jurisprudence that followed in the wake of the financial crisis in the late 90s and again in the early 2000s, earlier this millennium. A number of outcomes of those disputes suggested to us that we need to pay much more attention to what is the content, what is the substance of investment treaties. And I think probably the final impetus for reviewing investment agreements in the way that we have now undertaken is the recent challenge that the South African government has faced from Italian investors on the basis of a bilateral investment treaty that we have with between South Africa and Italy. So all of those, that background, so to speak, provided the impetus for the investment review, which, as I said, was finally started in initiated in 2007. Now, in this review, the objective of the review at a broad level is to provide for the first time a clear policy framework that would guide South African negotiators as they negotiate investment agreements. Now, most of the investment agreements that we focused on have been bilateral investment treaties or BITs. But there are also processes at the regional level on investment that we need to be aware of. There are processes at the multilateral level. So we're looking at bilateral investment treaties particularly, but we also are aware that there are other processes discussing investment provisions and investment agreements. What we've tried to ensure in this process is that whatever comes out of this this review is a product of a thorough consultative process, that the agreement, that the outcome of this and the guidance that it would provide for future negotiations would be consistently applied in all our negotiations, and that this framework would be signed off by our political principals, and this would give, I think, political cover to the negotiators that so far, I think, to a large extent has been lacking. The framework that we hope to finalize would set the policy parameters and objectives for detailed legal provisions that would constitute, ordinarily constitute investment agreements. And at the broad level, the future investment agreements should, in our view, be located in a broader human rights framework that gives emphasis to the rights to development. Future agreements should strike the right balance between the need to provide protection to investors, to balance that with the right of states to promote economic and social development, and that these should appropriately balance the rights and obligations of states with the rights and obligations of investors. At the same time, given the fact that South Africa is both a capital importing and a capital exporting country, we have investment coming into South Africa, but we're also major investors, particularly in Africa, we need to find the correct and appropriate balance to take into account that that reality. And then I think the final sort of broad issue that we have been concerned about in constructing, in pursuing this process, is we want to ensure that investment agreements that we conclude in future do not unduly or inadvertently undermine our national judicial systems and institutions. So that, Chair, is just by way of introduction to the topic. I will ask Suraya Adams, director, as you've noted, is a director in our division, in the International Trade and Economic Division. She's been one of the members of a core team that has led the process of developing the approach, going through the consultations, and she'll give a good sense of some of the issues around this issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Karim. Over to yourself, Ms. Adams.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members of the committee. And I'd just like to reiterate what Mr. Karim has said, in that we are thankful for this opportunity to update the committee on the progress we've made thus far in the review. If I may, I would like to just elaborate a little bit further on some of the background that Mr. Karim has already provided, to really give a sense of the rise and reign of BITs, or bilateral investment treaties, and to give some context to the position the status that BITs currently enjoy in international law and international relations. By way of background, the first BIT was signed 50 years ago, between Germany and Pakistan, and it was essentially designed as a tool to protect investor interests, German investor interests in Pakistan, which was a newly independent state in Asia, in South Asia. And thereafter, for a period of about 30 years, there was very little development in BITs. In fact, to a large extent, BITs were largely dormant and not considered at all a popular form of international relations promotion. And almost 30 years later, with the very first investor-state dispute between Sri Lanka and the UK. The impact and the implications of BIDS came to the fore, and that was in the late 80s, early 90s, which saw a huge takeoff in the proliferation and conclusion of BIDS between nations. Initially, BIDS were concluded largely between developed and developing nations, typically following the flow of investments from developed countries to developing nations. But more recently, and particularly in the latter 90s and early 2000s, we've seen a marked increase in BIDS being concluded between developing nations. And so from one BID being concluded in 1959, we now have over 2,600 BIDs concluded globally, a large portion of which is now being concluded between developing countries. And as pointed out by Mr. Karim earlier, many of these BIDs were designed along the template followed by the OECD model. And I will discuss a little bit later on some of the challenges faced by developing countries with that particular model. So that's just by way of background in terms of where BIDs come from and where we're at. It was precisely at this time when BIDs were taking off in popularity that South Africa emerged out of isolation. And it was also, as has been pointed out, considered a useful international relations tool by South Africa to engage with bilateral partners, and was considered an investment promotion tool as well. So when we talk about the statistics a little bit later on, we will see that there was a rapid rise, and the vast majority of our bids were concluded within that period immediately post democracy. I must qualify that by saying, however, that the first bid that South Africa concluded was with the UK and was signed post-democracy, but it was actually negotiated well before, in response, one may say, to perceived risks of investing in a new administration. So it was negotiated well before. And then more recently, the impact of BIDS has become a reality for South Africa in respect of the recent litigation or the recent arbitration which the government is defending and which has been brought by Italian investors in terms of the bilateral investment treaty between South Africa and Italy, and which directly challenges our minerals legislation, our new minerals legislation. So that's really, in broad terms, why we are where we're at. Coupled with that is the fact that globally there has been concern, particularly amongst developing nations, about the one-sided or so-called one-sidedness of earlier generation bids. The fact that developmental policy space is seen to be limited in the obligations contained in those bids, and several other countries, including developed nations, have undergone similar review exercises to determine a balanced way forward. So in that sense, South Africa is not entirely alone. However, South Africa is in a fairly unique position, being both a capital importer and a capital exporter, whereas other reviews have concentrated mainly on the capital export side or mainly on the capital import side. South Africa, in our review, we've had to be mindful of the fact that we need to arrive at a balanced approach which protects interests of South African investors abroad, but also ensures and guarantees our developmental priorities. I'm going to then talk a little bit about what is a BID, because in some of the consultations it became apparent that there isn't clarity on what a BID is. And I'll start off by saying that BIT is a bilateral investment treaty, a treaty being an agreement between states. And it's usually between two countries, and it's intended to protect and promote investments in the territory of the other party and is reciprocal in nature. So obligations and undertakings given are mutually mutually applicable. Very often, BITs are described or titled as investment promotion and protection agreements, or reciprocal investment promotion agreements, or bilateral investment promotion agreements. These are just all a different terminology for essentially the same type of agreement. In literature, in academic literature, it's common practice to refer to them as BITs, BITs, bilateral investment treaties, and with your leave, I will refer to them further as BITs. There are aspects of investment protection and promotion which are contained in regional agreements, such as in the NAFTA Chapter 11, as well as another example is in SADC, the Finance and Investment Protocol. In some types of trade agreements, there are also chapters on investment, which will include aspects of investment promotion and protection. But usually the BITs are standalone agreements and are usually bilateral in nature. I thought it important to give the committee a perspective of the conclusion of BITs since 1994 to date. And as indicated, we started off the process in 1994 with the conclusion of one BIT. We saw a very steady and rapid sort of increase in our negotiations, culminating in a spike in the conclusion of BITs in 1998, and that was just shortly before our second election, a democratic election. Thereafter, from 2000 onwards, we saw a decrease in the numbers, primarily related to the fact that there were concerns arising at the time around developmental aspects related to BITs. Some of the observations made at the multilateral forum, which Mr. Karim described earlier, and also some concern about the fact that we needed to adopt a more balanced approach in our negotiations. So we saw a steady increase up until about 98 and then a tapering off towards 2008. In terms of the regions with whom we have concluded a bit, Africa and Europe are equal in number, both numbering 16. In total, South Africa has concluded 43 bits, and of the 43, 14 have entered into force. The 43 can be broken up as follows. There are 16 equally between Africa and Europe, and then 2 in Asia, 5 in the Middle East, and 4 in the Americas. The large majority, the vast majority of BITs which have entered into force are those which were concluded with European developed nations, European nations, shortly after 1994. To provide the committee with an understanding or a little bit of background on the structure of the review that we've undertaken, Mr. Karim has already indicated the objective and the mandate. Essentially, the task team was mandated to physically review South Africa's concluded BITs, and in doing so to identify legal risks and other contingencies inherent in the BITs which are currently in force and those which have yet to come into force. Arising out of that analysis, the mandate is also to develop, if appropriate, a model BIT and to make recommendations to Cabinet in light of findings made. And the methodology underpinning the mandate would be one of a thorough consultation and research and analysis. To describe the methodology a little bit in a little bit more detail, a stock take and assessment of existing bits was undertaken, and this was largely because of the time that has elapsed since the first bit and up until now, as well as the fact that there have been changes in management, changes in staff, and records physically needed to be examined, needed to be collated, and travaux préparatoires needed to be studied in detail to determine some of the rationale, some of the thinking behind the conclusion of the bits, particularly the first generation bits. In addition to the physical stock take and the assessment, was a reconciliation of records within the DTI as well as those held by the Treaties Division of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, which is where all of South Africa's international treaties are formally housed and located. And the review consisted of two main sections. One was a macro review and was conducted on the basis of interviews at desk manager level and involved questions relating to the motivation and the policy background to underpinning the conclusion of BIDS. And the micro review was a very detailed legal analysis of the texts, which have already been concluded, and the legal basis and legal implications of the texts and obligations incumbent on South Africa in light of those texts. The macro review was conducted on the basis of a questionnaire, which bilateral desk managers within the DTI were requested to complete, and who were then interviewed on the basis of their responses to the questionnaire. In addition, SACU, SADC, AU, and NEPED desks were also interviewed to obtain the African and regional perspective on investment promotion strategies. And additionally, colleagues at erstwhile DFA, now DIRCO, and the presidency were also interviewed and provided with the questionnaire to obtain background on the role of BIDS in relation to South Africa's foreign relations and foreign relations policy. Because a large number of BIDS, as we've noticed, are often driven by our missions and by policies at the Department of International Relations.
You know, I'm also feeling extremely chilly. In fact, my nails have gone blue. And I know a few other folks are thinking of protecting their heads. There's only one problem with this menu. It's on public TV all the time. So that's why I haven't hidden under the table yet, you know, to get away from the air conditioning. But I understand that they are going to be addressing the issue now because it's extremely cold in some of the places. I think your seat particularly, if you look, and I don't want to suggest another seat because everyone is going to have a problem somehow. But they are addressing it, Honourable Mabasa, because I am feeling particularly cold myself. Are you lucky you've got a blazer on? Yeah. Sorry about that, Miss Adams. But it is extremely cold, yeah.
Thank you. And just to provide some information arising out of the interviews that were concluded, is that some of the information pertained to the fact that clearly the early bids or the first generation bids that South Africa concluded coincided with South Africa's entry into the global community, and the conclusion of bids were considered in broad terms as an investment promotion tool, In some instances, bits were part of a generic mix of agreements with a bilateral partner proposed during a state visit or official visits. And there, at the time, there did not appear to be any clear policy in place regarding guidelines or criteria for the conclusion of BITs. In respect of outward investment strategies, by and large, the response was that these were driven, the conclusion of this in this regard were driven by the need for protection of South African investors abroad, and again that there was no clear criteria in place. Equally, in inward investment strategies, information was around the fact that there, in general, there are perceived risks associated with investing in Africa, whether or not they are accurate, and BITs were considered as a mitigating factor in regarding those concerns. So these were some of the information that came out of the interviews, and which pointed to the fact that clearly guidelines or criteria or a policy framework needed to be developed in order to make the BIT conclusion process more streamlined and more clinical. In addition, some of our research also pointed to the fact that developing nations, as I've indicated earlier, developing nations are increasingly relying on BITs between each other. And this is also, the proliferation of BITs has also given rise to proliferation of investor-state disputes. And then, in light of the disputes, there has been emerging international law on the subject, which has been viewed fairly critically by several jurisdictions, particularly Latin American countries, some of whom have taken quite a radical approach and have denounced membership of ICSID or have discontinued any form of BITS at all. And this is particularly so because certain Latin American countries have been greatly affected or significantly affected by international arbitral decisions. A country like Argentina at the time of the Argentinian financial crisis had suffered great losses due to international arbitrations that were brought in terms of bids that it had with other countries. And similarly, countries like Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela have undergone a similar fate and have resolved in certain instances not to continue membership of ICSID, which is the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes, and in other instances to hold the conclusion of any further bids in abeyance. In addition, developed nations have also undergone reviews and have been considering ways in which model bids can be adapted or modified to include a more liberal approach to investor rights to investor rights. A country like Norway has just recently undergone a review, and it's interesting to note that even though it's a significant capital exporter, it has resolved after almost 2 years of consultation not to continue with any further bits in light of really divided public feedback on the question of bits. In addition to that, and this is a question that has featured quite prominently in some of the comments that we've received from both government stakeholders as well as public stakeholders, has been the question of the correlation between BIDs and FDI inflows and outflows. And the studies conducted in this regard have been widespread, particularly by UNCTAD, but as well as by other independent organizations. And almost, it's been almost unilateral that there's been no conclusive finding on a significant correlation between the conclusion of this and FDI inflows or outflows. There's been, what findings there have been have shown that there's marginal relationship between the conclusion of BIT and FDI inflow, but by and large, investors will base their consideration, their investment considerations on other factors related to market size and other more pertinent economic factors as opposed to the mere conclusion of a BIT or the existence of a BIT between a host country and a home country. Quite interestingly as well, there was a survey conducted in South Africa by the Edge Institute, which tried to determine the relationship between South African investment in Africa on the continent and the existence of BIDs on the continent. And the outcome, the feedback obtained from that process was that to a large extent, investors were not even aware of the existence of BIDs in some jurisdictions, and based their investment considerations on significant other factors. The agreements which, if an agreement was at all important to an investor, the survey pointed out, it was usually the double taxation agreement, which has a direct in financial impact on an investment. So these are some of the findings. They're available. The UNCTAD studies are available on the UNCTAD website. And it's really interesting because that's really one of the questions which we've had to grapple with. And it's unfortunately, there has not been sufficient data available in South Africa on investment inflows and the conclusion of that. So it's largely been based on what independent external studies have found, as well as this one particular survey conducted by the Edge Institute. And it's one of the recommendations, the Edge. And it's one of the recommendations we would like to submit is that there needs to be much more done in terms of data collation and analysis in this respect. Another interesting fact to point out is that it's quite interesting that there are no bids in place between South Africa and some of our larger investors, for example, the USA. Although we do have a bid with Canada, it hasn't entered into force, and Canada is a significant investor in South Africa, equally Japan, and equally some new emerging investors like India. Again, that brings one to the question of whether or not there is a significant relationship between the conclusion of BIDs and FDI inflow. And our research also pointed out that a significant a recipient of FDI, a country like Brazil, who is a significant recipient of FDI, does not have a single BIT in force with any of its bilateral trading partners, and yet still receives significant amounts of FDI. Brazil. So those are just some of the interesting observations which we were able to make out of the macro review. If I may, I'd like to talk a little bit about the micro review, which was much more technical and focused essentially on standard bits which we have been concluding thus far and the 11 standard clauses which are found typically in bits, some of which, as we've seen, have turned out to be fairly problematic, particularly the text of our earlier bits. And the clauses which one would typically find within a BIT would be a preamble, the definitions section, the geographic application, duration and termination, standards of treatment, which refer to fair and equitable treatment, national treatment, most favored nation treatment, the expropriation clause, the free transfer of funds clause, and dispute resolution. And some of these deserve a little bit more elaboration. For example, preambles, a study of our early bit preambles reveals that they were largely a standardized text, referred in broad terms to development of economic relations between the two countries, and in broad terms to promotion and protection of investment. They did not specifically identify the development aspect of the host country, and why this is important is that in emerging international law on the subject, preambles have become increasingly important as interpretive aids as to the intention of the parties. So where a tribunal would be wanting to determine whether development was an aspect of the intention of the parties, they would turn to either a specific clause in the agreement or to the preamble to determine the intention of the parties. In later bits, we find that aspects of development do feature in preambles, but certainly in the early generation bits, they did not. Equally, the definition of investment and investor, in our early bits, we undertook to protect all investment without qualification and without further elaboration. That would mean that if someone purchased a holiday home, a seaside home in South Africa, that could be regarded as an investment and could potentially enable or entitle the purchaser of such a property to make or institute a claim against the government. Fortunately, that along with global trends in the text of bilateral investment treaties.
You know, earlier on the folks where they do this monitoring of the air conditioning, the people had complained that it was too hot in here, and now they have the complaint that it was too cold. I think it's just right myself, but it does require that we, I suppose just through the way we're sitting may indicate that we're awake. That applies to the chair as well as all members sitting here. Because I think that that was part of the concern that they had.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And fortunately, those kinds of definitions, clauses have been modified and changed to reflect the true intention. Similarly, clauses relating to standards of treatment, expropriation, dispute resolution have all proved problematic in our early bits. And I'm going to just focus a little bit on two of the most problematic ones, and those are the national treatment and most favored nation clauses. And in terms of national treatment and most favored nation, I've quoted from the very first bit, the RSA UK bit of 1994. And just to explain that the national treatment clause provides for treatment of foreign investors no less favorable than that afforded to local investors. And so in a study of our bids, we found that our early generation bids provided almost no exception for affirmative action measures or empowerment measures to be taken for the development of previously disadvantaged persons. And in later generation bids, particularly the one that we've concluded with Ethiopia in 2008, we remedied that particular position by changing the text to reflect that affirmative that privileges and preferences may be granted to develop and to promote the development of previously disadvantaged persons who have been affected by discrimination. So that's just an example of how from 1994 to 2008 the texts have changed to include some of our priorities and to cater for some of our policies related to affirmative action and black economic empowerment. The most favored nation clause is a clause which provides that the contracting state is obliged to provide no less favorable treatment than it grants to third countries. So it essentially levels the playing field for all countries. And it does mean, however, in our current context, that more favorable conditions that were granted under early bids may be claimed by investors under later bids, and this is something which we are seeking to remedy in the recommendations that we make, and that is to limit the applicability of MFN to a certain time frame and to substantive issues only. The expropriation clause is another clause which is contentious, and as in emerging law has provided much deep debate and discourse. The OECD models, the early models, provide for immediate, full, and effective compensation, which developing countries have vehemently opposed, and developing countries have preferred to refer to expropriation as being appropriate compensation. And it's interesting to note that our constitution, in terms of section 25, 2 and 3, refers to just and equitable compensation and enjoins parties to take into account public interest in determining compensation. So there's a clear onus on parties to take into account public interest issues, which early generation bids do not necessarily require. Dispute resolution. This has also proven to be fairly contentious in that what bids did for the very first time in the late 80s is that they permitted a litigant, a natural person or a legal individual, but essentially private persons, were entitled to make claims against a foreign state in a foreign forum, thereby bypassing domestic legal jurisdictions in order to obtain redress. And this has been particularly problematic for many developing countries. This has been particularly problematic for many developing countries. The International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, is an institution of the World Bank and was specifically created in the 1960s to cater for investor-state disputes and thereby provided a forum for parties to circumvent, if you like, or to leapfrog domestic legal systems and approach international fora for legal redress. And it is this particular institution which some jurisdictions have chosen now to withdraw their membership from. I should point out that South Africa is not a member of ICSID, and therefore any dispute which is brought in terms of the ICSID Convention against South Africa is then permitted to enter into the dispute under the additional facility rules, which are somewhat more liberal than the ICSID rules. International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. And it's an institution of the World Bank and has been created by the ICSID Convention in the 1960s. There's a large authority of law now which exists in terms of ICSID decisions, and the majority of these decisions have been in favor of investors. There are some instances where decisions have been in favor of host states, but by and large the trend has been in favor of investors. In the submissions that we would like to take forward and from the findings of our research, we would like to submit that the South African domestic judicial system should be considered as a court of first instance or as a forum of first instance in any international investor state dispute. Just then to summarize what some of the observations have been in terms of the micro review, these were that largely our first generation bits, the ones concluded between 1994 and 1999, were fairly one-sided and were based on the OECD model. Our later bits clearly reflect the changing investment context and the fact that our developmental objectives needed to be prioritized, as well as the fact that domestic legal remedies need to be exhausted before referral to an international forum. The status and progress of the review, just to outline some of significant milestones. In March this year, our first draft of the review document was finalized and was circulated for government stakeholder consultation and comment. Significant comment was received, and a workshop was held with government stakeholders in April. Due to the overwhelming comments that were received, an extension needed to be granted for further government input, particularly from the Department of Public Works, which is currently engaged in the finalization of the expropriation bill and for whom BITs are particularly relevant. In June this year, the second draft, which incorporated the comments received from government stakeholders, was circulated for wider public comment, and an external stakeholders workshop with international experts as guest speakers was held in August this year, and members of the public were invited to attend the workshop. And we had quite a significant attendance from both labor, academia, business, and the legal fraternity. In September, just last month, we received additional comments and significant comments, substantial comments from the South African Human Rights Commission as well as the United Nations. And currently we are working on a third iteration of the document in which we hope to incorporate the comments we've received from the public and the international organizations in preparation for submission to Cabinet. Just to reflect on some of the comments that we've received, the comments that we've received thus far mainly pertain to concerns around upholding human rights and the fact that we should guarantee the right to development, ensuring South Africa's developmental policy space, and ensuring that we do not limit these by the conclusion of restrictive bids. Very importantly, that we should be in compliance with the Constitution as well as our international law obligations. And as I've already indicated, the need for data on FDI trends and the conclusion of these types of international agreements. And finally, the need for protection of South African business interests. And there we see the clear dilemma that South Africa is in terms of protecting interests abroad, but as well as ensuring that the right to development is also protected. Some of the recommendations that we would like to take forward would include the analysis and the assessment of the current position and the risks that we've identified. We would like to refer to the experience of other countries who have concluded similar reviews, and we would like to reflect on both the developed and the developing perspective. So the experience of a country like Norway is particularly important, and as well as the experience of countries in Latin America. In respect of the first generation bits, which are the problematic bits, we would like to propose that many of them are nearing the end of their term or the end of their duration, and that consideration be given to terminating the bits those bids in their current form and opening up the possibility of the potential of renegotiating bids on a more balanced basis. We'd also like to recommend that empirical data and analysis of FDI trends are important and that that these should be collated and analyzed. And finally, we would like to suggest that bids should not limit or inhibit South Africa's policy space and developmental priorities, but that it is also important to provide some form of protection to South African investors abroad. And that, Madam Chair, Honourable Members, is the end of this presentation.
Thank you very much for keeping within the time frame and also explaining it so succinctly in that time. Thank you very much for that. Now, I'll be over to the committee. This particular time, as one comes back after constituency, I've learned the advantages of brevity. So I would appeal to members to restrict their questions to two initially, to give everyone the opportunity of asking, and then we'll have another round. It's two questions or a maximum of 2 minutes, which could include three, whichever is exhausted first. So I hope I've made myself clear. Right, questions, please. Honourable Maria, Honourable Mabaso, in that order, Honourable Njikalana. Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was incredibly interesting to listen to you in terms of what you've said. And on the one hand, it certainly shows that you have thought about this. You've certainly looked around, and it seems like you've started applying your mind. Because I was writing down here, and I said to myself, what is the driving force of this? Is it offensive or is it defensive? Is it protecting or is it inviting? And I've said, and I've asked, and maybe the question is one of the questions is, what is driving this? Our need for investment or our need for protection? And I'm not quite sure from the bits, what is really, what are we really doing? And I know from the World Bank report, it says that I think we are number 50 odd in terms of how easy it is to do business. So clearly it is a stumbling block. And if I use the example that you've used of Brazil, which is a comparable emerging market to us, who has got no bids, you've said. And in the meantime they are getting the FDIs that we really need in dire straits. So is it then really, or have you incorporated into this whole process the need for FDIs and what is driving this primarily? Protection or offensive or defensive, or trying to get money or trying to protect? Because it's a huge difference between the two, and you can have two total different outcomes from that process depending on where your emphasis is. You might have both in the whole package, but the approach that you have will have a different message towards your possible investors. If you can respond to that, I'll appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Maria. Honourable Mabaso.
My comment is to say, I think it is critically crucial for developing countries as well as for countries in the South to appreciate that they have to come together, maximize unity between them in the trading world. Because if that doesn't happen, the exercise that we're trying to go into as South Africa futile, because all what developed countries have to do is to say, oh, so you are more strict, you are asking too many questions, we will just pack our bags and go to the next developing country, so that they will play one developing country against the other. You know, it will become such a mess that the developing countries themselves will end up fighting each other. It's like throwing a bone here, and it becomes dog eat dog. So, to what degree can countries appreciate this? Because, thanks, Coach. But on a lighter, on a comment, on the last question asked, I tend to think the balance, you know, but that's just my little contribution. That in fact, it must be a very careful balance that we must seek to strive.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Njikalana.
Okay. The whole document is red with my red pen. Now you scared me, so I'm gonna. Because this is thought provoking. I think the first thing is that it would have been helpful to have a sample copies of bits, because I reacted unfortunately very, very uneasy to this, because I didn't know what it was, and a summary of it. And also, if you could just share with us the key elements of the various categories of the BIT, you know, the IPPA, PIPA, RIPA. And the questionnaire was sent to SACO, SADC, and others. I don't see private sector and civil society organizations that have interest in investments and trade. Any reason for that? Let me stop the chair for now.
Thank you very much, Honourable Njikalana. I have just the two or three myself, and timing myself is not that easy. But the one you referred yourself to, a double-edged sword with perhaps Brazil on the one hand, not, as you said, didn't have a bit with any country that was investing in it, and yet the investments were rolling in, as it were. And on the other hand, just further on, you made a broader comment about certain developing countries, which I thought Brazil was probably classified as well. Actually, in the light of these the arbitration and the tribunals, they're actually now removing themselves from these dispute tribunals due to what was seen as a real unsatisfactory result from a lot of those countries and so on. So I'd like a better understanding of that. What are these implications there? I mean, South Africa itself is not a part of this dispute resolution. And yet, on the other hand, we do want to be part of the collective community, both of the developing countries and South-South, etc., in trying, if you like, to develop a negotiating block, in inverted commas, to negotiate in these areas. The other aspect that you raised in that regard was that the somewhere along here, that people were often only aware, investors, potential investors, of only the double taxation issue and nothing else, weren't even aware if they were bilaterals or not. Were you referring to huge international companies as such, or countries, so the private sector, in inverted commas, and were these new private sector organizations or private sector organizations that had some representation within the country, as it were, already? And the last question then would be, in terms of these bits, it's not very clear, and I'll come back to what the Honourable Moraes is, perhaps he's looking at it from a similar point as well, I'm not sure whether we think it's a good idea or a bad idea. You know, what are you actually saying? That is a good thing, or it's not a good thing, or it is, but we don't like the arbitration tribunal. You know, what is it that we like and we don't like, or what is serving South Africa's interests? And then you finally made the comment that we must be in compliance with the Constitution. But it would appear as if the early bits done in 94 to 97, maybe, when we did have our Constitution, did not comply. Now, I'm not sure just whether those bits are still in operation. Yes, sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. On average, what is the life expectancy of these people?
I have a suggestion to make. It will also allow some organization here from the two people from the department to just literally a 3-minute break to fetch food and come and sit down. Literally fetch and come back. It's not actually a break, a tea break. It's just an opportunity to rise from your seat. I was just fortunate that I learned inadvertently that Siraj's mum passed away about a week ago, if I'm not mistaken. And I said to her myself, but I'm sure all of us share in her loss. I mean, to replace a mother, no mother is ever replaceable at all. Leaves a huge vacuum emotionally and every other way in a family and in each individual member. So I'm sure all members of the committee share with me when I pass on the condolences in a more formal manner to yourself. And as usual, you're back at work very soon, but do convey that to our family as well. Thank you. Members, while you're enjoying the little repast that was organized, perhaps we can hear from DTI, from Mr. Karim, and his colleague, Ms. Adam, here.
Sure, we'll try our best to answer, I think, what were very good questions, and try to take them in the sequence that they were asked, and Surya Adam will also contribute, supplement my answers. I think the first question, what is the driving force behind BITS? It's never a straightforward answer in these. I think originally BITS were advanced by developed countries, industrial countries, that were investing in developing countries. And so their concern would have been that perhaps the legal frameworks that operate in developing countries were not of a standard, or that they felt they had any sufficient degree faith in that they would be able to deliver outcomes if there was expropriation of that investment. And so they would try to encourage, and that's a polite word, it would have been more like force developing countries to sign bilateral investment treaties which would then allow them, if an investment that they made in that country, one of their investors made an investment in a developing country, if it was expropriated, they would be able to ensure that there was compensation provided for. So I think that's what been the driving force, and I think Suraya's explanation of the very first bit between Germany and Pakistan illustrates that Germany as the capital exporting country trying to ensure that its investment in Pakistan is protected. Now, I think that is, in general, the story. I think over time, as different countries have become capital exporters, they've started to invest overseas, even developing countries, they've also tried to ensure that they have some so they're able to ensure that their investors or when they invest abroad have some protection. So that would be the original, I think, one of the original considerations in it. The question that also has to be asked is what is the link between concluding an investment agreement and FDI flows? If you conclude an agreement, does it mean it translates into new FDI flows that wouldn't have occurred if you didn't conclude the agreement? And all the studies for many, many years have suggested that there is no direct correlation. The example of Brazil never having ratified a single bilateral investment treaty, but still continuing to get investment, shows that investors would like to have an investment treaty in place if they could. But what's much more important to them is that they will invest because there's a profit to be made. There's a return to be made. So the driving force for investors is the return to their investment. And there they would take into account the legal regime in that country. They would probably prefer there's an investment agreement in place, but it's not a decisive factor in deciding whether or not they're going to invest. There are countries in Africa that have signed many, many investment treaties with many, many countries and have not got the types of investments that they thought the investment agreement would generate. South Africa, we signed 14 that have been ratified, and our track record on attracting investment is not particularly stellar as compared to other developing countries. The driving force for investment would always be the profit that the investor believes that they would get, and so it's a factor, but it's not decisive. The reason South Africa, I think we tried to say this in the presentation and also in my opening remarks, that South Africa's the proliferation of agreements that we entered into in the immediate post-apartheid period was driven by two factors. One, all of these were requests from European countries to conclude an investment agreement with South Africa. Many of them felt that with the change in government, they wanted to ensure that they would that their investments would be protected, would continue to be protected, and if there was nationalization in a new post-apartheid South Africa, there would be compensation. So that was one aspect of it. I think from the South African side, it was not a. I don't think we looked at it we didn't make a full assessment of the implication of the bits, but we understood bilateral investment treaties to be part of our efforts to re-enter the global community. It was part of our efforts to say we are prepared to sign these agreements because we are open for business. We are part of the international community. We want foreign investors to come in. And the agreements in those days, I think, were presented as unproblematic. They were not seen to be substantive agreements with heavy obligations. Some of the earlier agreements, I mean, even going back further, were understood to be friendship agreements. This is a way of giving a sense of comfort to investors from other countries. But I think in the course of our experience of implementing bilateral investment treaties, the international experience that has happened, the case that has been brought against South Africa, it means that we need to have a rethink about those investment treaties. And I think in the comments that have been made, the answer would not be, are bilateral investment treaties good or bad? I think the answer would be, one would have to strike the right balance. They can be an important instrument for creating an environment that would allow you to attract investment, but you need to ensure that in signing an agreement that is legally binding and subject to international arbitration, that you do so in a way that doesn't unduly limit your ability to implement development policy. So, and I think that's the problem that we've had. The early bits were established, the model bilateral investment treaties were modeled on an OECD model that the balance was tilted in favor of the investor. So the investors have all the rights, and the obligations were by and large put on the state to provide that protection. There is not a proper balance in ensuring that the investors also have obligations when they reinvest, human rights obligations, other obligations to contribute to economic development on the one hand, and also that the states also have an obligation to their citizens to provide, to implement policies that promote economic development. Now, that to a large extent was never an issue for South Africa until the case came before international arbitration, where South Africa's Minerals Act, recent Minerals and Resource Development Act, which is an attempt to ensure that the benefits of mineral resources are shared more equally, was considered to be an act of expropriation by those that held the rights previously under the bilateral investment treaty. So it was under the bilateral investment treaty between South Africa and Italy that Italian claimants have raised this challenge. Now, that's a separate question. I don't think we're in a position to talk about that case because that case is still going on. But the point is that it was raised on the basis of a bilateral investment treaty of the earlier model that we were talking about, the first generation. So the provisions in those early agreements don't provide us with sufficient comfort that South Africa can implement black economic empowerment or programs such as that, that we would need to. And so that's the question of making sure that we get the balance correct in it. So I think the answer to some of the questions and some of the comments that were made this is what the review is talking about, that we would need to make an assessment. Is it important for us to conclude bilateral investment treaties in order to attract investment? With which partners? We would need to answer that question. And the second question is that if we're going to negotiate investment treaties, what are the types of provisions that we would like to see included in them? And we would want to ensure that there is a proper balance. Provide protection for investors, but at the same time ensure that it's consistent with South Africa's constitution, ensure that it serves human rights framework that is enshrined in the Constitution, and that it allows us to protect our development space. Just a couple of other points. I take the point from the comment on the importance of South-South unity. And I think the second comment around that was ensuring the balance that is required in pursuing bilateral investment treaties. And developing countries, to a large extent, I think in many areas share common views, but there are a number of areas where some developing countries would take a particular view on particular issues which may not be completely aligned across the board. So it's not surprising to see that even on issues like investment,
not all developing countries would be members of ICSID. It's not uncommon to see not all developing countries even take common positions, say, in the WTO on specific issues. These are defined or determined on the basis of specific calculations on the particular issues at hand. On the question of, we can certainly provide some copies of bits. Certainly the bits that have passed through Parliament in the early period would probably be a useful good example for members to look at to see what they look like. They're very unobtrusive. They look very innocuous when you look at them. Very short documents, 11 provisions, very straightforward. But the legal implications of them are far-reaching from a policy perspective and from even from a financial perspective. So we clearly can share that. I think the last point, and I'll ask Sureya to maybe elaborate a little bit more on it, but the specific provisions in the agreement, some of the key elements in the agreement, I think the one question was about to elaborate some of the key elements. The 11 sort of standard provisions in an agreement, the preamble, the definition of investor, the definition of investment, definitions of expropriation, thank you, Sureya, geographic application, standards of treatment, dispute resolution, those are the standard provisions. How those are drafted are absolutely critical. If you draft an expropriation provision in an open-ended way, any regulation that a country may want to implement that could be interpreted as somehow affecting the profits of a company that has invested, they could interpret it as indirect or some form of expropriation. So it has to be drafted in a particular way. When we talk of national treatment, how you define national treatment becomes critical. If you combine national treatment with saying that you cannot treat this is where some of the ambiguity arose, you cannot treat a foreign investor less preferably than a domestic investor. If the domestic investor is benefiting from a black economic empowerment program, could that be interpreted as a violation of the national treatment provision? That's the ambiguity in it. So the need to then draft it very carefully around what you mean by national treatment, what you mean by most favored nation, etc. So I think this process that we've gone through has helped us to consolidate from a South African perspective. These debates have been going on at a multilateral level in other regions for some time, but it allows us, I think, from a South African perspective to begin to consolidate what would we like to see in the definition of investment and investor. What are the types of expropriation or the terms of expropriation that we would be prepared to live with. Now, I think the final point to make is, again, the point that was made in the presentation, is that if South Africa was only a country that that attracted investment, we may have a particular perspective. But as a country that also has an interest in protecting South African investment in other countries, we have to take that aspect. A South African business investing elsewhere wants to have some protection in some cases. So we need to think about that and finding that appropriate balance between as a capital importer and as a capital exporter. We have to find the right balance. And I think that's the key in this thing, is finding the right balance in this agreement. And these are the work that the team has been focused on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Karim has touched on virtually all of the comments that were raised, but just some interesting information which also came about is that, you know, we were not able to find a single BIT between developed countries, and one has to ask oneself the question, why? Is that because there's mutual trust and confidence in the the systems, legal and financial, economic and otherwise, of those countries? And if so, what prevents us from having similar systems in place, or what is stopping us from promoting our particular judicial systems, financial systems, etc., as being good enough to withstand standards set elsewhere? So that's one other interesting aspect that we were also able to make an observation on, and we're still looking for a PIT between developed countries. If we are to find one, we would certainly let the committee know. The other point which Mr. Karim has also touched on is really the importance of the actual drafting of particular clauses in BIDs. And from our research, we've seen that some submissions which have been made by the International Institute on Sustainable Development and other organizations which are proposing model BIDs are proposing BIDs which exceed 200 pages. Our initial OECD models are probably not longer than 4 or 5 pages. And that's really indicative of the complexities and the issues which have arisen in international investment law and which are now having to be canvassed in later model bids. And I think if the committee is interested, we can also make the model bid which the IISD has developed available to clearly show the difference between early OECD models and then some later developments in terms of ensuring and guaranteeing sustainable development, human rights, and developmental objectives. So that's also another interesting observation, just to show really to what extent the drafting will have to change and become more involved and more in-depth to cater for all of these kinds of situations, particularly in the South African context, related to affirmative action, preferential treatment, black economic empowerment, human rights, etc. And then in terms of the life expectancy of the BIDs, typically the duration would be 10 to 15 years, with an additional allowance, if no notice is given within the applicable time period, of an extension of a further 20 years. So the duration of agreements are 10 years. Notice can be given after the expiry of 10 years for termination or continuation. In the absence of notice being given, the protection grant will continue for a further 20 years. So that's the early texts. And then in response to the chair's question of the awareness of the private sector of these bids and the survey which was conducted by the Edge Institute, that survey was conducted on South African companies investing in Africa and concentrated on the private sector. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, government was not interviewed in that process. In response to the question from the Honourable Member regarding the questionnaire, the questionnaire was developed for internal use. It was circulated to the SACU desks internally at the DTI, the NEPAD desk internally at the DTI. So it was not circulated outside of government. It was only the DTI, DIRCO, and the presidency who were consulted on that particular questionnaire, largely because it related to the conclusion of BIDs and the rationale informing the conclusion of BIDs and the texts of particular BIDs. I think those are the comments I wish to make.
I was thinking in particular of Honourable Jikalana, one of your questions, which was quite broad. I'm not sure if you feel it was answered. And the other one was the Honourable Maria, but I think yours may well have been answered, perhaps not as effectively as you would have wanted, but I think they were responded to. Are there any other clarifications or comments or questions? Yes, Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chair. We know that in the investment world, that is to a large extent driven by perceptions. Perceptions of risks, perceptions of return, and the quantity and the easy of return. And by what Mr. Kramer said, that by and large, this these a bit have been initiated by the investor countries in South Africa. And that leaves the perception with me that they've got a certain perception of South Africa in terms of risk, primarily. If it was about return, they would just not invest here. So it's a perception of risk. And then I'm asking myself a question. When you deal with the issue of perceived risk, it is obviously in terms of the protection of your investment, but also the environment in which you are doing business, whether it's easy to do business, and then you look at the World Bank barometer that says it's not really that easy and cheap to do business in South Africa. And also, you know, whether you can get your money up whenever you need to do that. I think in terms of the portfolio investments that we've seen in South Africa, that clearly indicates to me that there's a perception of not high risk, especially if you see what happened over the last year, that there was a continuous flow of portfolio investment, which is high risk investment. And it was easy for them. So there was certainly a confidence in our financial systems, in our stock exchange. So that is something very positive. And then I'm asking myself, why do you need so many bits? Surely then one must look further and say, how do they see us as a constitutional state? Do they trust our constitution? Because we believe we've got a very good constitution, but do they trust our constitution? Do they trust that whatever is in the constitution, that will be implemented and be practiced and used whenever there's a problem occurring? And maybe one must rather focus on that, because I say to myself, these issues will come out. Whether you can pick and choose who invests with you, or whether you are in dire need of someone to come and invest. So there's a huge difference between those. And we know that there are so many investment opportunities, especially in emerging markets these days, that somehow one must assess the competitiveness with other emerging markets. And clearly what Ms. Adams has said, what have they done? How can we adjust and change approach, policies? Is it government? Is it the department? Is it the ANC? Is it the DA? Who's contributing to this perception that occurs? And somehow we must make it more easy for them, not only in terms of perception, but in terms of practice as well. That is easy and it's smooth to do business. The one thing that maybe was not addressed particularly, and that is, it's been touched on the role of private sector, but maybe within this environment, the role of private sector, how do we see the role of private sector, and whether that right is protected, and then specifically that of the state versus the private sector, and additional to that, the principle of PPPs. Public-private partnerships, how do we see this? I don't know, but maybe there's more comments, but I would like to get your response to that, whether, you know, are we off track in terms of that, or are these the realities that face us, that we must try to go and go and cling and see, you know, which of these is applicable that we need to adjust in South Africa? Thank you very much.
Play good soccer once you're able to avoid eye contact at crucial moments. All right, does the Honourable Indika Lana have his hand up here? I hope we won't take a letter out of that book, Honourable Indika Lana.
Okay, in terms of time, once again, I have a proposal to make. before
we have the proposal afterwards.
Okay, questions. Okay. Let me just switch off then. Chair, just as a comment, it's commendable that there is, in my observation, that there is an emphasis to shift from one-sided bids to bids that ensure investment context, and as well as the emphasis to ensure that developmental objectives or development policy stays as well, grappling with that and even promoting in South Africa seems to be the key point now. That's one. Number two, regarding the progress, in August, external stakeholders workshop was held. That's out of interest, which one? Which stakeholders were invited? I understand they were expect from overseas. But once again, given that this is a new area, I mean, in the last term, I don't remember having been exposed to this. Why, what about the public representatives? Why pull us at the tail end? Because I mean, I'm still trying to grapple with the bids, how they relate to trade, how they are located within the WTO environment and the like. Is there any reason for that? The ICSID, or the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes, what a long name, is located in the World Bank. Why? Why not in UNCTAD or WTO? I mean, it may sound as a naive question, but I'm just provocative that I see those two, just as an example, as being more appropriate institution to locate such a facility to handle investment disputes. You make mention as well of the need for data on foreign direct investment trends. It just triggers a memory that I think in 2006, there was someone who came and gave us an assessment of the investment climate in South Africa. Probably a rejoinder might be helpful now. It was very eye-opening, and quite a number of us were not exposed to that. The need for protection of South African business interests now. Yes, Trick, with South African business interests. Established business on one side, SMME. I tell you, through your chair, why I'm asking this. The recent, Consumer Protection Act is one of the good examples as to why, at times, there's a very specific need to focus on SMEs, because that very act was, interestingly, protecting SMEs against the big conglomerates. So with that memory, behind in the back of my mind, I'm asking then, whose interests are actually how is the protection of business interests, articulated. I think also the presentation is quite helpful, but Ms. Adams, said quite a lot of fundamentals and substantive issues just verbally. For us to understand this, it might be helpful. Those of us who like reading to have a better exposure, because I just have a sense this bit business will definitely have a profound effect, whether it maintains this current status or it proliferates in the future. So I think from the onset, just be helpful for us, even the presentation. Unless maybe the department will share the draft that will be presented, the report that will be presented to the cabinet. Those two are more or less the same.
cancer?
Just two things. The one is perhaps just a procedural issue here and how the logistics. Members of the public should be outside of these railings unless they are directly part of the DCI or of the parliamentary, I think it's called the monitoring court, PMG arrangement, and so on. So I just need to find out. I got a note from someone, but I didn't recognize the person concerned as a member of the committee. So perhaps the person concerned, I don't know the name, that's the unfortunate part, could perhaps let me know if they are a member of the committee, perhaps from the NCOP or another committee.
Chairperson, I'm not a member of any of the NOC or neither of this committee. In fact, I'm from the public. In fact, I always attend portfolio committee meetings. In fact, let me introduce myself. My name is Pascal, the surname is Musia. In fact, I'm the chairperson for Kaya Lagunya Human Development, which is an NGO out in Gugulethu. So we said we have 13 divisions and 23 subunits. But I'm also a master's student at the University of the Western Cape doing a master's student in management. So
I asked you to put all of that in writing to us because clearly with a couple of degrees under your belt, you're able to do that. And then you let us have it because members of the public are welcome to attend, but not in the area where committee members sit. You're very welcome.
No, quite understood. I always attend, in fact, like I've been attending portfolio committees for the past 10 years.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
But now, in fact,
I'm not allowing you to continue. I want to get on with the meeting. So, and I like to know who's here, and I have everyone's name here, but I didn't have your own. I actually thought you were a member of the staff, unfortunately. So, if you can just go where the railings are, or on my side, or the side, really doesn't matter, or right at the back there. All right, that would be fine. And then you can engage me afterwards. All right. No, I actually want to get on with the committee meeting. No, I'm going to have to stop you. That's what I'm... Please, I want you to be able to participate when we know what the briefing is, okay, but otherwise I don't know in what capacity you are. So please, just, there are lots of seats there, and you can equally participate in that manner. All right. So I just want to raise two questions myself. The one question is with respect to the 20 years. You said that automatically kicked in. Automatically. Now that worries me because my question would be, does DCI and the Department of Foreign International Relations and whoever else, does it have an actual database of all of these, as you call them, old bilaterals? And do you have the deadline for these bilaterals? Because I have realized that some of this information is not always readily available. This committee would hate to be surprised by something, a series of them that are getting an extension of 20 years suddenly. You know, that to me would be quite alarming. Can we get that very, very clear? The other thing is, and I know a proposal will come after you've made responses to what we've raised here, but there is a concern, certainly from myself and I think from all members, that we're trying right now to arrest the deindustrialization within our own country, to promote manufacturing and various other things. And some of these bits don't look as if they're
are that supportive of what we may be facing right now, right now. And one would want to learn from yourself, perhaps in a note, just which bits are of concern to the DTI itself because of the current economic environment, and also our priorities to try and address that and arrest unemployment, poverty, and various other issues. Because as you yourself have said, it would appear as if this is largely a defensive mechanism and protection mechanism from the developed country and not the developing. So if you would do that, and then after you have finished responding, I'll take a proposal that the Honourable Njikalana has indicated he wishes to make.
Thank you, Chair. I think, again, a good series of questions and comments. I think the first point about underlining the issue of understanding a bit in the context of understanding perceptions of risks and returns, I think that is quite a useful way of approaching it. And clearly, where countries feel that the risk for their investments in another country is high, then they would be pushing more strongly for an investment agreement. I think there's also an issue in South Africa's case about the timing. And probably in the immediate post-apartheid period, there have been concerns, perhaps from international investors, about the future direction of economic policy in South Africa. And that would have pushed them at that time to conclude bilateral investment and treaties with the South African government. Now, I think perhaps if we're talking it now 15 years or so down the line, perhaps those same perceptions have been attenuated, and perhaps the same perception of risk in South Africa may have been attenuated. So it may not be the same driving force from developed countries anymore. So I think, I mean, that does mean that, and I think, I mean, that's the one part of the question. The other part of the question, I think, is that in the immediate post-apartheid period, I don't think there was sufficient attention by government, by South Africans in general, of the implications of this. Over a period of time, I think we've generally become more aware of what the implications can be. As I was saying, there's international experience over the last 15 years that demonstrates clearly there are dangers and there are serious issues that are embedded in investment agreements. And now we're reaching a point where we need to review and rethink our approach and perhaps have, for the first time, a clear approach to this. Just to say that, I mean, portfolio investment, I take the point on portfolio investment. I mean, it's high risk, but clearly it's showing some interest in South Africa, and we continue and have for many years attracted portfolio investment. And I think from certainly the government side, and I'm sure a number of, from many quarters, we would have preferred to have greater levels of FDI, long-term investment in productive capacity in South Africa, which we haven't had. But just to say that the bilateral investment treaties generally don't cover portfolio investment. They are protection for long-term investments, foreign direct FDI type investments. Question is, I mean, and I think this is the question that came out in the presentation, and one of the points that I made in the opening, my opening remarks, were the question of the trust in South Africa's constitution and trust in South Africa's legal frameworks. And perhaps now the question that we've been posing is whether or not bilateral investment treaties, because of the provision on dispute settlement, which allows a company
a foreign investor to take the South African government to arbitration in an international fora and thereby bypass South African court system, doesn't that undermine and weaken our national legal system? So part of the question would be the same question that I think Sureya tackled in a different way. Why don't we have this between developed countries? Because presumably there's a trust or there's an understanding that their legal systems are, in fact, have the integrity that they're considering. So we need to look at that question as well. And perhaps it is different today as it compared to 15 years ago. Some of the points that were made by the Honourable Member on the role of the private sector, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. And the question of the public-private partnership and how that relates and the ease of doing business, I mean, I think they are related. They're clearly related to an environment that is attractive to investment. Certainly the ease of business would be one factor that a company would look at, or an investor would look at. But on the other hand, I think what we're looking at is at the bilateral investment treaty, and particularly the legal provisions in the bilateral investment treaty is where the concerns that have arisen. And that's precisely what we're trying to address through the review. But clearly, the types of issues that were raised by types of issues about the environment would be general issues about South Africa's attractiveness as an investment destination. But I'll go back to the other point: is there are many studies that when they categorise when an investor is looking to invest in a country, what do they look at? And ninth and tenth down in the list is the question of the investment, a bilateral investment treaty. They would be looking at the legal regime, they would be looking at profits in that area, they would be looking at can they get their money out in time. Those type of things would be higher, would be much more prominent in their in the criteria that would make them decide to invest. Bilateral investment treaty is much further down the list. On the question, I think on a number of questions, on the need for balance in the agreements, and I think that's what we've been trying to argue for. I'll ask Sureya to give us a rundown on who the stakeholders have been in the consultative process, because I didn't participate in all of those processes. The question of ICSID and why is it located in the World Bank, I think it's probably a particularly historical moment where it was decided, but there are other fora to settle disputes that are in the UN, UNCITRAL, which again I'm not sure what UNCITRAL stands for, but it's another arbitral body under the United Nations framework that could also be used for settlement of international investment disputes. The question on data on FDI, I think we would also see if we can't have some updates on that. But I think the question about the relationship between BITs and SMMEs is not an easy one for us to answer. Bilateral investment treaties that South Africa would presumably enter into would depend. If it was a country where we are where we are an exporter, say if it's another African country, then that protection would cover South African business operating in those countries, and it would cover all South African businesses. But it's unlikely that small and medium enterprises would be investing in foreign countries. It's not impossible, but it's more likely that our bigger companies would be the ones that would be looking for that investment in a foreign
in a foreign market. The relationship of SME for a bilateral investment treaty with a developed country that was investing in South Africa, I'm not quite sure how. Sorry.
The only reason I'm interrupting you is not because we don't wish to listen to you at all, but there's just an important part of this issue that has to be addressed, which is linked to the proposal. For us to adopt a proposal which is going to come here now, we need a quorum. To listen to you, we could do that with 7, 1 next person and so on. But just so that members are aware, we expect to finish at 5 to 6 in 10 minutes. However, I am assured by the committee secretary, if there was anyone who was stranded, he has the authority to organize a vehicle. So I'm just looking at one or two members. It's not our intention to finish late. I hope that's quite clear. Is that quite clear? So, just before we lose the quorum, because we are on a tight quorum, Mr. Cohen, is I would like to just hand this back to the Honourable Jikalane. His writing is a big improvement on mine, but I still find it difficult to read. But it's a lot better than mine. Could we just interrupt you just for a moment to get the proposal possibly passed, depends on what we think. So would you please put it on the table?
Okay, thanks. The proposal is read as follows. This meeting of the Portfolio Committee for Trade and Industry held on Tuesday, the 6th of October 2009, noting the strategic importance and implications of the bilateral investment treaty, is hereby resolved to 1. Empower itself and Parliament as well in a comprehensive manner on PITs. I'm abbreviating chair. 2. Arrange initially a joint session with the Portfolio Committees for International Relations and Cooperation, Economic Development, as well as Finance, together with the Select Committee on International Relations and Trade, to ensure enhanced understanding and insight on BITs, and also invite experts to make presentations. Furthermore, such joint sessions should include a detailed update on BITs that strengthens your point share that if there may be a BITs underway right now. 3. Explore creative ways and means of sharing experiences and collective approach with countries of the South in capital, that is in the context of South-South cooperation, with particular reference to Africa, IPSA, as well as bilateral agreements with China, India, and Russia. Full stop. However, such exercise must be preceded by policy refinement.
I think, in short, it is highlighting the challenges that we're facing with the BITs, which most of us would agree on. It is, the second point is making it clear that this is not the only portfolio committee dealing with BITs, and that it becomes important to include, to be inclusive. The third, and they all revolve around that, except for the third one, which spoke about the policy refinement. And I just needed that clarified for the benefit of the committee. Who is doing this policy refinement? Yes, did it say that specifically?
Oh, no.
Ah.
Yeah, that's a mistake. Yeah. Thanks for throwing my attention on that.
So it would be safe to say that we would seek a policy refinement from DTI. It sounds quite constructive and operational for us to move on. With one proviso, we're not even thinking of that this year, obviously. Yes, Honourable Moret.
Madam Chair, I haven't got a principal problem with what has been said there, except that, you know, I've got no problem with IPSA and with even Russia, China. But what we are doing is we're excluding the larger part of the IPSA partners, which is America, which is Asia, which is Europe, which is Middle East. So I would rather see that we don't exclude some of them, but rather look, you know, to in other words, not be particular on certain agreements and certain relationships, that we look at what are we confronted with in terms of this, and that we can look at, from these, we can look at various. So I would support it with that amendment.
Right. I think you've heard of the proposed amendment. We've had the proposal. There's a will support, but an amendment. Yes, Honourable Mabasa.
I also second, but with also a proposal that we add part of that, all the practical part on our side,
yeah.
So that we don't look at ourselves as only NA,
yeah.
But also NPOP, especially because a big component includes receiving input, etc.
Now, what I'm going to do, yes, Honourable Wood.
Chairperson, I wanted to second the proposal Mutatis Mutandis.
Mutatis Mutandis, okay. Now, the thing is that... What? Well, what I'm going to ask is, I would like this typed up, because there have been different permutations around the place, all right? We are going to be at quorum tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm looking at everyone here. Right. So, let's have that. I'm not going to immediately ask this. It has been proposed. I think we do need to study it because I've heard two or three mini amendments to it, including my own. Can we do that? And you'll have it ready for tomorrow. Thank you. Now, we will proceed. Mr. Karim was very rudely interrupted. He's now going to complete. I hope there will be a few people left to listen.
Conclude rapidly. I think the one question was about writing up this document, and I think we do have a document that has been used as a basis for our consultations. Certainly prepare that for the committee. I think the question that the chair raised, we should just make it clear about the duration of the agreements. By and large, and it depends, not every agreement is identical, but by and large, the agreements run for a period of 10 to 15 years. That is their duration. If at the end of the 10 to 15 years, there is an agreement to extend it on both sides, it can be extended. If there is no agreement to extend it, or one of the parties indicates that they want to have it, they would agree to have it, they want it terminated at the end of its duration, 10 or 15 years, that can happen. But the investments that have been protected under that agreement would continue to be protected for another 20 years. So those are the types of, and that's I think some of the imbalances that we were talking about, that these were just accepted. And on the one hand, one would understand that the investments are long-term commitments and can take, and when an investor makes an investment would want protection for some period of time. But I don't think we've had any assessment to say, you know, should it be 10 years, 20 years, or this has been it. So what we're seeing now is many of the earlier bids that were signed in 1994, 95, 96, 98 are coming to the end of their term around now, their 10 to 15 years duration. The question is, what do we do beyond that? In any case, investments that are protected under those agreements will continue to be protected for another 20 years. But one could reopen the negotiations, can attempt to change that, and that would be also some of the considerations that the review would consider. And then the final question, I think, Chair, that you had raised was which
it's of concern in light of South Africa's current economic challenges. And I think it's very difficult to be precise on that in light of current policies, etc. But I think in general, what one could say is that the earlier agreements, all of the earlier agreements, in our view, are imbalanced and would need to be reviewed. And we would like that opportunity. And I think when we get a chance, we would try to do it. The other agreements that have been negotiated post in the last 9 years or so are probably better agreements. But even some of those, I think we need to strengthen them and improve them in specific ways. I may not have left much for Surya, but if she wants to add anything.
Thank you, Chair. Just in response to the question from the Honourable Member about the invitees to the external stakeholders workshop, representatives from business, so BUSA, NASCOC, a number of business organizations were invited, Business Leadership SA, including our representatives from trade unions, so all of the trade unions represented at NEDLAC were invited. We invited several academics from several universities in several jurisdictions, including the Western Cape, Free State, Gauteng, Limpopo, etc. And then the legal fraternity was invited in the form of invitations to the General Council of the Bar, the Law Society of South Africa, and the various provincial law societies. And then some NGOs were invited as well.
I think that probably at this point concludes the input we'll be receiving, but we would appreciate if you would put these certain things in writing that have been agreed to and let us have them in due course. And we'll let you know exactly where we're going with the proposal. It's not going to happen tomorrow because we already have a full schedule. But the bids have turned out to be something of great challenge facing us right now. As you yourself say, there are many challenges here. And there's also the subtext as to why the developed countries don't have any between themselves. You know, I mean, it does raise a number of issues. I think the Honourable Maria pointed to a few, as did the Honourable Mabasa and Mr. Kalana. So I'd like to thank you most sincerely, Mr. Karim, as well as Ms. Adam, for being here with us this afternoon and sharing this information with us. It has been highly constructive, and I know I speak for the whole committee. Thank you. You know, they're different watches, obviously. I'm not sure which one's the transport company pursuit. You know, that's always a problem. They seem to have a unilateral sort of approach to time. And I know that myself, nearly killing myself running after a bus once. But it is 10:02 on my watch. I don't know about anyone else's. But you're welcome. Oh, sorry, yes, here it is on the computer, 10:02. So do try and get the buses if you are going by bus. If you have a very genuine problem, because I know some villages have a problem, please let us know. Thank you. And this is adjourned then until tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. in M for Ma or Mother 46. And I would appeal to members of the ANC to be there earlier as agreed.